This is a Pinball News production.
Hello. Okay, usually I like talking more off the cuff, but there's a lot of information here, so I'm going to use the paper teleprompter here. So this story starts 17 years ago in the last years of in the last year of Williams Pinball's existence, but obviously we didn't know that at the time. One day, John Papaduke grabbed me in the hallway and told me I had to immediately come look at something in the storage room across the hall from Steve Kordek's office. Steve had all kinds of interesting things in there. There he pointed to a kind of disheveled heap of full-size playfield drawings and told me they were designs Harry Williams had made in the 70s, but they'd never been produced. I sifted through the first few, and my first impression was that Harry had clearly lost his mind. He'd gotten old and senile. Here were 1950s playfield designs that he was drawing in the 1970s. But still, I was fascinated. All these games designed by the master himself that had never seen the light of day. I could never really get the whole story out of Steve Kordek. Harry was sending in these designs to Steve. Steve was kind of sitting on them. It really didn't make any sense. But John was very excited about them. He decided there, then and there, that when it came time to design the next game after we were done with Star Wars Episode I, we would start by having Jim and Jose in the Whitewood Lab build up one of these games so we could play it. Not because he really thought that we'd end up producing a game anything like it, but because he thought good pinball juju would flow from Harry's brain through the game into our brains, and we'd be inspired to create a true pinball masterpiece in the mold of Harry Williams. Despite John's more recent misadventures, there's no denying that he's an absolute pinball zealot, through and through. His wonder and excitement at the thought of traveling back in time to learn at the feet of Harry Williams via these playfield designs, it was contagious. We needed to finish up Star Wars and get it into production and show it off as the tournament game at Pinball Expo, and then we were going to hit the ground running on the next game as Disciples of Harry. It gave me goosebumps. And then, as you know, on October 25th, 1999, it all came crashing down. There were tears to be wept, new jobs to be found, lives to be rearranged, and more important things to worry about than a stack of old playfield drawings. But I didn't forget them. As the years passed, I'd talked to Steve Kordek at various nostalgic get-togethers of ex-Williams employees. He'd discuss how all of his personal belongings, files, papers, games, books, everything from his nearly 40 years at Williams had been moved up to the plant in Waukegan, and he was trying to figure out how to get them out and back home. I own a pickup truck. At the time, I lived near the Waukegan plant. I have an undying devotion to the cause of pinball history, and I have a very understanding boss, Larry DeMar, so I offered absolutely unconditional help to Steve in this regard. Anytime, any amount of stuff, moved to any place he wanted. I always asked if those Harry Williams drawings were still in his stuff, and he always assured me they were. I even bought a giant document scanner cheap on eBay and fixed it all up, all in preparation for the day I got my hands on these drawings. After a few years, we managed to get some of Steve's games out of there. Suspense, Ringer, Pinball Circus. After many more years and some personal intervention by Ken Fidesna, we finally managed to get a large cache of his files out of there, but it was only about half of it. They said the rest was in off-site storage, and now that we had cleared out the first batch, they would have room to bring the rest of it back inside to sort through before letting Steve have it. Two things Steve and I verified that day. The Harry Williams drawings were absolutely still around in the off-site storage, and we also found out that off-site storage just meant a semi-trailer sitting out in the parking lot. The folks at Williams said they were really busy from then until the big Vegas trade show in the fall, but we could check back later in the year to coordinate coming back for the second half of Steve's stuff. Later that year turned into more and more years. No amount of pestering could get any further action out of Williams. Steve couldn't get them to return his calls. They certainly weren't returning my calls. Only one person had control of all the storage portions of the factory, but they also required people from legal to bless anything leaving the building. So it required some coordination, and it was nobody's priority. As Steve got older and realized he needed to make plans for all of his vast belongings, okay, I'll say it, his hoardings. He was a complete hoarder through and through, but pinball history is so much richer for it. He decided that Larry and I would be worthy keepers of the historical flame. That first batch of files from Waukegan came back to our office and filled our common area like a bad episode of Storage Wars. As I slowly sorted through it and organized it, Steve would come by and visit and chat and offer guidance about what it all was. As he neared the age of 100 and his health was wavering even more, he made it clear to his family that upon his death, a lot of his files from his basement at home would come to join the rest of his archives at our office. There's Steve at his 100th birthday party. And when that dreaded day came to pass that Steve passed on, all those files did. We had even more stuff at our office. But his death also marked another sad milestone. We had never retrieved the rest of the files from Waukegan, and now he was gone. I was never going to see those Harry Williams drawings again. Someday, someone at the plant would be cleaning up old junk, not recognize those drawings for what they were, and off they would head to the landfill. I couldn't bear the thought. I pulled out all the stops. I got the email address of a lawyer at Williams who I was told could slice through all the red tape and make this happen. I wrote him an impassioned plea, describing the situation and begging for help for me, for Steve's family, for pinball historians everywhere, to get the last of his archives back together after all these years. A few days later, I got an email from a Williams paralegal basically saying, "Sorry, there's no more stuff of Steve Kordek's here." I was crushed. That was it. The lost playfield drawings of Harry Williams were now truly lost.
Nice job, Geraldo.
Over the next couple of years, my pinball history itch was scratched quite nicely by sorting through the portions of Steve's archives that we had succeeded in rescuing. Triaging, organizing, filing, scanning, uploading to IPDB, it was a lot of distracting work, but the thought of Harry's drawings was never far from my mind, especially when, in a mouse-infested tube of rolled-up drawings from Steve's garage, I found blueprint copies, bad blueprint copies, of a couple of them. Hey, at least I had proof in my hands that I just didn't dream up the whole thing. But in this same time, that one person who had control of the storage areas in Waukegan, the very last person with any memory there of Steve's stuff, retired. And Williams merged with another company, and then they merged again with Bally Gaming. And then they moved manufacturing to Las Vegas and moved out of the plant in Waukegan. If I had even the tiniest sliver of hope for these drawings, it was now gone. Then one day, in June of 2015, I got a call from Gary Flower. He's always calling with some interesting question or a tidbit of pinball information, but today his question about made me weep. Now, instead of embarrassing myself by attempting a British accent impression, I'm going to have Gary Flower himself read what he told me on the phone.
Okay, so here we go. This has been sprung upon me. So. Duncan, I remember one time, back when Williams was still in the pinball business, I visited Steve Kordek, and he led me into a room and opened a cabinet and showed me a bunch of playfield designs that he said were done by Harry Williams in the 1970s, but never got made. Do you know anything about those or where they might have ended up?
Thank you. Needless to say, that was a question that made me go, ah! That was a very sore subject. I gave him the very, very condensed version of this story and told him it was too late. Williams had left the building, literally, and if those things had still been there, they were now gone. He told me that the people were gone, but Williams was still organizing and moving the contents of the building and preparing for an auction later, so maybe now is the time to try to find them at last. I pointed out that pretty much anyone with any care for pinball was long gone from any position of power there, and how could we possibly get in to look around? He asked if I knew Tim Seckel, and I said I did not. He said Tim was VP of engineering at Williams now and had designed pins for Data East and was a diehard pinball fan, and maybe he could help. So he put me in touch with Tim, and I gave Tim the even more condensed version of this story. He said he would personally drive up to Waukegan and look around for these drawings. A few days later, he called me back to say he had no luck finding them. There were just the old production playfield drawings from the 40s through the 70s in their normal storage cabinets. And I said, whoa, I couldn't let that go past without comment. I told him purely as a person greatly invested in the history of pinball, I wanted to know what was going to become of those drawings. I would certainly hate to see them chucked as old useless pieces of paper. He totally understood and said he'd call me back. Next time I heard from him, he also had a Williams lawyer on the line and basically said, okay, we're listening. What do you propose happens to these drawings? Talk about being put on the spot. Clearly, they were never going to go for the answer of, hey, just give them to me. The first thing I could think of was the Strong Museum of Play up in Rochester. They're an honest-to-goodness real museum. They could donate them to, they'd be happy to get them, and they could join other priceless artifacts of coin-op history like the Atari Engineering Archives. Tim and the lawyer liked that idea. But there was one hitch. They didn't just want to give up the drawings without getting copies of them, but all of their document copying equipment had already been shipped to Vegas, and there was certainly no money in anyone's budget to send these to Kinko's for copies to be made. I said, well, I have a crazy idea. I own a document scanner big enough to handle these. Let me have those drawings briefly so I can scan them and send you copies or the files, and then I'll pass them along to the folks in Rochester. And lo and behold, they went for it. I had to sign some legal documents, but then they set it up. And then right in the middle of all this, my wife Julie was diagnosed with a very rare and aggressive form of breast cancer. And we were spending a lot of time in hospitals getting tests, but she's a big pinball fan. You might be able to tell from the far out tattoo there. And bless her heart, she encouraged me to get this done while working around her schedule. So there I am one holiday morning before July 4th at an eerily vacant Williams plant in Waukegan, explaining to the security guard that I'm trying to pick up some boxes or cabinets full of paper. He finally finds someone who knows something about it and directs me to park at a loading dock at the far end of the plant. While I'm sitting there waiting for the door to open, I see a lone semi-trailer sitting in the lot. Is this the infamous off-site storage? I actually emailed a picture of it to Tim Seckel, asking him if anyone had thought to check in there. He later responded that the plant security folks assured him it was completely empty. It was worth a shot. So they loaded up my truck with two metal cabinets and a giant cardboard box just crammed full with rolled up and crushed vellum prints, and off I drove to my office to unload it all into the poor beleaguered common area, site of so much pinball history de-hoarding. I told my wife I'd be right back home, so there was no time for anything but dump and run, but I can't resist just peeking in the cabinets to see what I'm facing in terms of scanning. And aw, crap, some of the prints have fallen from their hangers or are getting all crumpled and kinked in the bottom of the cabinet. I pull them out to lay them flat, and then I look at them a little more closely, and then shivers go up my spine and I feel a little faint. I won't relay to you the long string of joyful expletives that I actually said out loud in this empty office. I'll just tell you that I was staring at some of the lost playfield drawings of Harry Williams. I checked the cabinet and they were all there, over 60 of them, hanging merrily alongside the early production playfield drawings that were all I'd expected to find. It was painful knowing I wouldn't be back here for days until after the holiday weekend, but I had to go home, though with a huge grin on my face. Steve had hidden those suckers in plain sight. I called Tim Seckel later that day and let him know so he'd stop searching the nooks and crannies of the plant to find them. I called Gary Flower and let him know that his offhand, out of the blue, later than 11th hour question, along with my, oh, by the way, question about the fate of the production playfield drawings, had actually led to a successful end to my 16-year quest. And still, the Harry Williams drawings had to stay tantalizingly just out of reach for a while longer. I'd made a deal to scan all the production drawings for Williams and then ship the originals to Rochester, and that promise took precedence. A month later, I wrapped that up, but at an extreme amount of damage to the expensive wear parts of my scanner due to how old and damaged the Williams drawings were. So still, Harry's legacy had to wait while I resurrected a parts scanner I'd picked up from eBay along the way. After all, I wanted these scans to be flawless. But I finally got it done. 60-odd scans of these giant, detailed, full-sized, fully dimensioned playfield designs. They were frankly unmanageable at full size. I couldn't even get my head around them at that scale with so many of them. But once they were scanned, I printed them all on 11 by 17 paper and put them in a binder, and I could finally take stock of what I had. And what I found was genius. My first impression of these had been all wrong. I was misinformed by only looking at a couple of the designs and not fully understanding what they were showing. But now what? A 16-year quest, the first 13 of which had been spent with Steve Kordek by my side, and the last three on my own, and now that I'd finally done it, now what? And I don't think there's really any question that these games needed to be built. 40-odd years after Harry put pencil to Mylar, some of these games needed to finally be built and played. Harry Williams once described the appeal of pinball as the ball is wild, and in these designs, he tried to ensure that was true, in some cases in ways that had never been seen before and have never been seen since. Harry loved gimmicks and gadgets and was always dreaming up new and unique mechanisms for coin-op games, and these designs are no different. On many of these drawings, the game description includes the phrase, "See supplementary drawing," for details on a unique mechanism. Sadly, those supplementary drawings all seem to have been lost to time. But it's possible in context to figure out how most of them must have worked and how they'd need to be constructed. There's a series of a dozen or so games that have some sort of weird scoring magnet thingy that had me a bit stumped until I realized Harry had used this exact mechanism on his eighth game from Williams, 1947's Torchy. So I can just use a torchy mechanism as a guide for where to start in building this slightly different magnet mechanism in these games. And yes, I bought that torchy just for this reason. While all of these thoughts are going through my head, there's still the nagging question of why. Why are these interesting games sitting here on pieces of paper and not in the history books as successful Williams pinball machines? Steve had never given me a straight answer, and he was no longer around to pester for more details. Norm Clark was the other Williams designer at the time, but he too has passed on. I thought of trying to see if some of the draftsman or prototype shop names I had seen on all those production drawings belonged to people who were still alive, but the odds of any of them knowing anything about this seemed very slim. It's Al Cardenas, who I believe is still alive, and Steve Alborn, I don't know the fate of, but just working in the prototype shop, it seems unlikely that they'd know anything. But I stumbled upon the fact that Jack Middle was still alive and living in the area. He'd been head of marketing at Williams from the early 60s all the way through the dawn of the solid-state era. Maybe he'd know. It took a while to finally arrange to talk to him on the phone because he was in his 80s and had a lot of regular medical appointments. Finally, Steve Ritchie and I paid him a visit at his home one weekend because Steve considers him his mentor from when Steve started at Williams in the late 70s. Jack was not specifically familiar with this cache of unmade games, I guess because Steve had squirreled them away all these years, but he did outline for me the circumstances that would have led to this situation. According to Jack, Harry had a couple of ex-wives plus a penchant for dating fast women. Now, those are Jack's words, not mine, which is apparently a very expensive hobby. So he would always been looking for sources of additional income, and with his love of pinball and his design talents, what better thing to do than pitch game designs to his friends at his former company? But here's the thing. It's not enough to just have a game design. You also need someone to shepherd it through the whole process, to get resources allocated for it, to make sure all those millions of other things get done that are required between the time you have an idea on paper and games are shipping out the loading dock. In my time at Williams, I heard this referred to as the game dad for a game, a term coined by Larry DeMar. It doesn't always have to be the designer, though it often is. It just has to be the person most interested in seeing that game gets made. For instance, on Junkyard, Dwight Sullivan was the game dad, even though Barry Osler did the majority of the playfield design. So you can see the problem here. Steve Kordek and Norm Clark have their own designs they want Williams to make. They're not going to volunteer to be game dad on someone else's design, even someone like Harry that they know and like. So there's the brutal truth. These games didn't get made because making them would have meant Steve or Norm giving up a production slot for one of their own games. I guess that's why Steve was hesitant to discuss this, because unless you really understand the whole situation, it sounds kind of selfish. But I get it. And kudos to Steve. He hung on to these drawings for decades. He didn't just feed them into a shredder. A sad postscript here. Jack Middle passed away a few months after we met with him in April of this year. Now, here's another little fun fact I discovered. Once I had both Harry's drawings and the Williams production drawings in my hand at the same time, however briefly, two of the games in this series did actually get made, sort of. Harry designed a four-player game called Valencia that later got reworked a little by Gordon Horlick into a two-player game called Toledo. You can see there, it's the same thing. They actually made 65 Valencia sample games, but it never went into full production. However, they made 3,001 copies of Toledo, and it was a pretty successful game. There was another game, a two-player design called Tramway. That's Harry's original drawing, and it was reworked a little bit, again by Gordon Horlick. There's Gordon's version. And they went as far as to make one or two fully complete games with artwork and scheduled it for production, but production never happened in the end. I asked Jack about that, and while he didn't remember Tramway specifically, he said that if a game didn't do well at test locations, it didn't get made, period. He was in charge of that sort of decision, and it came down to whether he thought a game would be able to recoup its production cost if sold at a deep discount in a worst-case scenario, and if the earnings were not there, production was not authorized. So there's kind of a vote of no confidence in these playfield designs by Harry, but maybe they just picked the wrong one, or maybe Gordon's tweaks weren't the right ones or something. So who was this Gordon Horlick? That's actually a subject James Laughlin and I will touch upon in our seminar tomorrow at 10 a.m. There's a plug. But I'll give you the short version. He was Harry's and Sam Stern's longtime employee and engineering buddy going all the way back to the earliest days of Williams in the 1940s. Here's some of the early drawings where Harry was writing notes to Gordon, telling him, you know, what was going on in the design or whatever. By the 1970s, he was actually in charge of engineering at Williams, and though Jack Middle kept insisting to me that Gordon was no game designer, He did have a hand in a lot of the really early Williams game designs, and clearly he was willing to step up and be game dad for Toledo and Tramway, despite not officially being in that role normally. Once I decided to bring one of these designs to life, then the question became, how do I possibly choose which one? First, I whittled it down by rejecting all the ones with the scoring magnet thingy, because that was going to be too much mechanical engineering to complete in time for this pinball expo. Then I removed from consideration all of them with unusual bottom-end flipper arrangements. Those games are almost always failures. I know they have their fans, and I didn't want to take such a big risk for the first one. Similarly, I ruled out ones that required overly complicated mechanisms or rules, including a few with multi-ball, as Williams had no multi-ball in the 1970s EM era, which I could use to start building a game. I'd have to create that from scratch. Then I tossed out a few that just didn't look fun or interesting enough, and that got it down to 14. Then I took a harder look at the time I had remaining to build the game and the complexity of the hardware rules and got it down to just 9. Then I just had my wife help me choose one of these, and she picked Typhoon. So Typhoon it is. It was only after we decided on Typhoon when I finally noticed that, in addition to the whirling mechanism and the pop bumpers, it also had upper slingshots. The ball was truly going to be wild. Okay, another extremely sad postscript here. My wife passed away a couple of months after that, in July of this year. It's been a very tough year, but she was excited as I was at the prospect of bringing one of these 1970s time capsules to life, so I press on. I sure do miss that girl. I love you, Julie, and this seminar is dedicated to you. Okay, here's where I probably need to take a moment, but I'll go on. Okay, I knew by starting with an existing Williams parts game from the era, I could bring up a flipping Whitewood pretty quickly. All the right voltages are there, the player up, ball in play, and basic scoring circuitry are all there, and so on. So I decided I was going to give this game the exact treatment it should have gotten in the Williams prototype lab 40 years ago, including programming the software using relays and steppers. No cheating with a P-Rock or something here, no siree. The design may have been asleep for 40 years, but it was time to wake it up from its suspended animation, just like it was still July of 1972. And that game is here at Expo now for you to play. Remember, this is the first Whitewood. If this really was July of 1972, Gordon and Harry and Steve and Norm and Sam would all play the game and perhaps find flaws and tweak things. But I'm not worthy of second-guessing Harry's initial design, so I built it precisely like he drew it, and we can all play it and decide how good a job he did. And maybe some of that pinball juju will flow from Harry's brain through his drawings into the Whitewood and then on into your brains. If you see me around the show, let me know what you think of it or post a thread to RGP and let the people who couldn't make it to this year's expo know what they're missing. It's my plan to build up more of these games. I might just try one of those scoring magnet thingy games next. Some of them have 5 magnets. Might need a new connection to ComEd to power all those at the same time. Check back again at next year's expo and see what I've come up with. I'll end with 2 personal plugs. If you have any trashed out, unrepairable Williams EM part games from the 1970s that you're willing to sell me cheaply, I'd like to pick up a couple more to use for building up these games. And if you'd like to do something to help put an end to the scourge that is inflammatory breast cancer, please consider giving a donation in the memory of Julie Caples to the IBCnetwork.com. Thanks. And I will, of course, take questions if you have any. Okay?
Condolences on your loss. I want to start
Thanks.
With that.
Thanks.
Do you think that the deal was resulted from a personal relationship with Sam Stern?
Oh, absolutely.
And
yeah.
This was, do you think there was any sense of keeping the designs away from any other companies or just...
There are so many ways the mind can go on that. Was Harry sending them in thinking they'd get made, and Sam was letting them get sent in thinking we're never going to make these? Or was Harry sending them in knowing they'd never get made? Were they being done right to keep them away from competitors as a favor? Who knows? By that point, he had basically sold the company to Sam Stern, but then Sam Stern had sold it to Seberg and X-Core and all that. So at that point, while Sam was in charge, he didn't just have free reign of things, so he still had to answer to shareholders and things. So, you know, obviously he was doing some sort of favor to Harry, but was limited into what he could do. And plus there was just, you know, unless Harry came back to work there and got his own team with him, they were just really never going to be made. So.
Duncan, you said originally that the thought was maybe because of Harry's lifestyle, he needed a little extra cash to bring his
home. Right.
Did we address the question of did he actually get the cash? Why else send him 63 drawings?
I do not know the answer to that question.
Yeah.
Right. It is clear to me from gaps and other little bits of copies I have in Steve's files that isn't even all of them. He sent in some before that. There's a very long stretch where he was sending in three designs a month, a one-player, a two-player, and a four-player every month. And then there's places where he didn't have all those, or months where there are none, and I have to wonder if he was sending in ones and they've just been lost. But this is the complete set that Steve still had when pinball shut down, so it's what we've got. And if I build one a year, I won't live long enough to do all of them, so it's plenty, I think. Yeah, maybe two a year. Yeah.
But then he did go on to design games for Stern.
Correct.
So it's almost like he continued to send them in and they just...
Started. Oh, to Sam. Yeah, maybe. Right, sure. Once Sam had his own company again where he didn't have any shareholders to answer to, sure. And Harry was keeping busy doing other stuff. I mean, during that time he had like some coin-op slot car thing that he did. I mean, his mind was always working and he was designing games. It just, there were no pinball machines for a long stretch until, like you said, he got a few done with Stern, the original Stern. Yeah. 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 And again, you know, always with the weird mechanisms or little tricks and things. He was a brilliant guy. Yes.
I'd like to turn to the Typhoon game itself.
Okay.
So I played it extensively, and some of the other people in this room, we had some pretty deep discussions about it, and a couple of things that we weren't sure about from what you posted of that drawing tie into questionable aspects of the design. So two things. Number one, do you have any further information about the motor to know that you are using a motor that has enough energy or enough speed to represent what he wanted?
No, there is no information on that drawing about what speed he wanted, only the direction and that it should be running the whole game. So I, doing what they probably would have done in the Whitewood lab, I grabbed one of the most common motors of that era that spun kind of fast and put it in there. I agree with you, it should probably go faster, and that's probably the determination they would have made after playing it, and they would have gone and spec'd a faster motor. At some point, since it's being hit by posts on plastic, you don't want it to go too fast or they're going to snap off. But I suspect you could go twice that fast and have a more interesting game.
Yeah, and question number two, it's a reference to the 1-4 lanes at the top being made randomly. Do you have any sense of how that ties in with the idea that they're actually numbered?
That's a term of the art, randomly versus in sequence. If they were made in sequence, you'd have to make one before you could make two,
and
so on. So he has games that have features that go both ways, and that's all he meant. Anyone can be made at any time. Other things I had to just guess at, he has his little sketches of art on the playfield that I've then printed out and transferred to the Whitewood just so people have some clue what was going on. Talked about the side eject holes collecting the bonus, but nothing about the out hole collecting the bonus. And out-hole bonus wasn't exactly a standard thing at the time, so I didn't have it do it. And again, first Whitewood, first pass of the electronics. If I were going to, you know, keep working on that game, I would probably make the out-hole, you know, non-bonus rack off a lot quicker because it's kind of painful to see, you know, 9,000 not bonus counting up as you're waiting for the ball, things like that. Yes?
So, Duncan, now that you're going to have about a year before you got to bring the next one.
Yeah.
What, are you going to go for a crazier design?
I think I'm going to do Firefly, which you can see the bottom of here. There's actually a fifth magnet higher up. There's a magnet between the flippers, okay? And the way these things work is the magnet is on the whole game, and so the ball gets near it, the magnet attracts it. And right in the center of the magnet, there's a rollover button and a switch. And as soon as the ball hits that, the magnet turns off. So it kind of like flings the ball, in theory. The ball gets attracted, and then about the time it would want to center in the magnet, that turns off so that it lets it go in the direction it was going. So it should fling the ball pretty hard. So in that case, it's going to fling it right into a post between the flippers, maybe, or fling it down the drain. I don't know. So some of these game designs, to me, look like they are going to fail. I mean, because all he did was draw them out of his head onto the paper. None of them have ever been built, tested, nothing. As far as I know, he didn't have a little lab where he tested pieces of it or anything. This was just all his crazy ideas. So, yeah, I want to build that one and see what happens. Yeah. That's to make it easier to see, I only gave you a little bit. So, yeah, farther up the playfield, there's a fifth magnet. And
an observation, the device on Typhoon, spinning disc. I was intrigued how that was made with the posters upside down.
Yeah, that's what he drew on his drawing. Yeah.
What I found bizarre is his time frame was out on the floor, but he got a similar device on.
What?
fast game at the back of the hall, it was just all that wood.
Okay.
And the game that American Bimble was showing.
Oh. Haha. Okay. Well, all good ideas eventually get repeated. And it's funny, a lot of the stuff I'm seeing on Harry's games, all like there's one that has this weird baseball man running unit, and it's not like the kind where they pop up in the back. It's balls that get caught in a disc on the playfield. So they're like all contained, and it'll shove a ball into a hole in the disc and then turn it, and that'll represent the man on base. And a couple of months ago, Clay Harrell had me pick up some old exhibit supply game that he bought in Lake Forest, and I went and picked it up for him, and from like the 30s, I think, maybe the 40s. Oh my God, there's that exact mechanism on there. So Harry had like stolen this idea from exhibit supply, but of course, then you figure out Harry was working for exhibit supply, so it was probably his idea in the first place, and then he just reused it on this game in the 70s. Anyone else? Yeah?
We were wondering if you thought Harry might have been informed about potential future, up voltage of the solenoids, that they were going to, I guess that was in 72.
Yeah.
Well, of course, that would have happened over the layer, but, because the way that a bumper action is at the top, especially the top center,
wasn't it? I mean, it's got DC bumpers in it, so. And the slings and the bumpers are all DC, so they're about as powerful as you're going to get for the era. No. I mean, that was much, much later that they did 50 volts. Yeah.
And the only reason I wondered about that is obviously given Harry's history with electrical and like you say, the magnets, exhibit magnets before that.
Yeah.
That discussion.
I don't know. Yeah. Like I said, the faster Typhoon motor, I'm going to be interested to see. I might do that. We'll see. And this, I built it like he drew it. I actually made one change from the way he drew it. Right at the very top where the ball goes through the gate, there's a post there, and he didn't leave enough room. You'd shoot it, and the ball would just get wedged. So, okay, I had to change that one. But he would have done that, too, when they built it. So, yeah, I just moved it over a little bit. But everything else, I just did it like he did it. And that's all. I was kind of weird about this. I wanted to do it like they would have done it in 72. So that's all hand-routed. I had people offering, oh, let me CNC route that for you. I'm like, no, I'm going to, there's a drawing. Every center point is marked, so I did it like they would have done. I laid it out on the piece of wood. I poked a nail through every center point and did all my drilling and routing off those prick marks, and there you go.
So. We were trying to make that left shot, and the first thing was unmakeable off the left.
It's tight.
I made it.
Yeah. It's tight. Again, I think that's the kind of thing they would have play tested and gone, I got to move this a little bit. But again, I just did it like you drew it. You had, yeah.
Are you planning on doing a back glass for this one?
Well, yeah. I get so many people saying, where's the art? It's a whitewood.
You have the back glass website.
Yeah, I know. Part of me, it kills me to have no art on that game. Like Clay Harrell is desperate to steal the game and go paint on it, I think, but it is what it is. That's exactly what they would have done the first time they built it. Is it would have just been blank. They may have put some notes on there. They probably would have written it on with pencil or grease pencil, and my handwriting's not that good, so I just took Harry's writing and pasted it on there. And then they would have played the heck out of it. And then after some tweaks, then they would have gone to add posters and gotten some art and done all that. But I was just trying to create the very next step in the process that got interrupted so many years ago.
What about publishing the drawings? Is that up to the Strong Museum now?
Oh, no, I've got these drawings. The Strong Museum has the production stuff. And I asked Williams, okay, they've got the originals, you've got copies, can I send little downsized ones to IPDB? And they said no, and they wouldn't tell me why. So the production ones are Williams and Strong, and they can figure that out someday. This stuff is part of Steve Kordek's personal archives, and so I've got it with all his other files that I've got. And I don't know yet. A couple of my friends in the pinball industry have said, when they saw that binder, were like, oh my God, I need a copy of that. And so they do now have a copy of it. But in terms of publishing it, I don't know. One game a year for 63 years, you can see them that way.
Well, you could recruit some other people to.
Yeah. Crowdsource it. Yeah.
So if I go to Rochester,
again, the production playfield drawings. Yeah, but no, these I've got. You could come to Northbrook and make an appointment, and I could probably show you the drawings. But anyone else? Is that it? Thank you.